for all being here, and thanks for listening to my talk. And I want to report about some work which I did with our postdoc in Seattle, Emmanuel Katz, and it's about how to add flavors in the ADS-CFT correspondence. And some of you might have heard this before, but I hope for most of you it's new. So there is this old idea, this quantum chromodynamics might in the end just be a string theory, and this idea comes back from Toft's observation that in the large n limit, so where n is the number of colors, the Feynman diagrams of QCD or of any SUN kind of gauge theory organize themselves into Riemann surfaces, and these Riemann surfaces are the Riemann surfaces of a closed string theory. So the Feynman diagrams themselves organize themselves into Riemann surfaces which are weighted by powers of n, and the power of n is 2 minus 2 times the genus of the Riemann surface. And in order to get this expansion, you want to take a limit where the number of colors goes to infinity, the coupling goes to zero, keeping this Toft coupling lambda fixed. Just wanted to show two transparencies how to get this counting in the cheap and easy fashion. So the easiest way to get this counting at large n was to write the Lagrangian with the normalization where you have the 1 over g squared sitting out front, and then the funky way to write 1 over g squared is to write it as n over g squared n, so then this you keep fixed, this you send to infinity, and then you have basically the propagator and the cubic and the quartic vertex all come with the same free factor. The only funny thing in this normalization is that you get factors of n from the propagator itself, get 1 over n with every propagator, and both the 3-point and the 3-point and the 4-point vertex gives you positive factors of n. And the only additional factors of n you get from doing traces in color space. So whenever you see a trace of this delta ij, where this is the delta, the SUN delta matrix, then I get an additional factor of n. And to count properly those factors of n, Toft introduced this double line notations, where everything that's in the adjoint representation, like the gauge field of SUN, you write 2 lines. Instead of writing 1 propagator, 1 line, you write 2 lines to see how the color indices run. So I get 1 color index running this way, another color index running the other way. And then I get a factor of n from every phase in this diagram when you have in this double line notation. So every time you see a closed loop, I get a power of the, I get a factor of this trace of delta, which is another factor of n. And so this counts the number of phases in the diagram. So then if you put together the factors of n from the 3 sources, we got positive powers of n from every phase and from every vertex, and we got a negative power of n from every propagator, which then you call edge in this diagram, and then you also get some predetermined function of lambda. But if you just look at the powers of n, you see that they come with this vertices minus edges plus phases, and this is a well-known topological object that's just the Euler character of this Riemann surface. So if you can write your Feynman diagram on a genus G Riemann surface, you're guaranteed that these numbers of vertices minus edges plus phases will sum up to 2 minus 2G. And then you find that any kind of amplitude which you might want to calculate will be expanded in a form like this, where you get a sum over Feynman diagrams which you can write on a genus G Riemann surface. You get an n to the 2 minus 2G, and then you have some function of lambda which will depend on the genus. And then you would say, well, this just looks like the perturbation series of a string theory. I expanded my amplitude in terms of Riemann surfaces of higher and higher genus. And then what kind of string theory this is then will then be encoded in these functions g of lambda. So there should be some string theory which is dual to this Young-Mills theory, whose perturbation series you just wrote down in powers of 1 over n. And once you know what the string theory is, you could actually evaluate these functions of lambda as well. So Polyakov tried to make this a little bit more precise, and what he said is that the string theory, if you want to describe QCD, you should actually look for a 5-dimensional string, which kind of sounds odd because QCD is a 4-dimensional theory. But what he wants to say is that the 5th dimension should somehow encode the thickness of the string. And because if you look at real QCD, where you have these quarks sitting at the end of some flux tube, and you want to think of this flux tube being the string of which you quantize in QCD, this is like a fat string, whereas the strings which we always like to quantize are fundamental strings, infinitesimally small strings. Then he wants to introduce a 5th space-time dimension to kind of encode that this fact that the string can have an internal structure and can have some thickness. And also this is going to avoid that the immediate contradiction which you could derive, namely the strings have like very soft behavior at high energies, whereas QCD, we know, has a very hard behavior at high energies. So somehow the physics of the 5th dimension has to conspire to make the soft string theory amplitudes look hard. And then the geometry of the fifth dimension will be the internal structure of the QCD spring. And so the one more transparency, how does he visualize this to work. So this would be, this is a 4D picture. So you have one quark here, one quark there, and some kind of shaky flux tube in between, which kind of fluctuates in all different ways, and in particular can fluctuate kind of in thickness. And the way this would look from the fifth dimension is you have an infinitely thin fundamental string, and instead of having thickness fluctuations, it fluctuates in its position in the fifth dimension. So this fat string is a fundamental string in one more dimension, and in this sense, this description would be holographic. And the really amazing thing, which people realized a few years ago, people meaning Juan Maldacena, is that this actually works. So this is not just a fancy idea, but there are some theories, some cousins of QCD, for which you actually can write down the dual string string. The easiest examples are those which are superconformal, so they're supersymmetric and conformal, and have some amount of supersymmetry, and then this dual string theory background is an ADS5, that is this non-compact five-dimensional space in which the string propagates, and then you add on some compact space to make the whole thing 10-dimensional, so you can actually put the superstring, critical superstring on this. And then afterwards, people also found non-conformal examples of this, and the most famous non-conformal deformation is the one by Klebanov and Strassner. And this actually describes something which is almost pure n equals 1 super Young Mills, so it's pure n equals 1 super Young Mills, and a few extra heavy fields, or lots of extra heavy fields. And so this theory is very exciting because it has qualitative, very similar physics as real QCD. So it shows it has confinement and has some kind of chiral symmetry breaking. A discrete group gets broken down to some discrete subgroup. So for some supersymmetric cousins of QCD, this works. So I had a few more transparencies explaining this in more detail. So first, why are the conformal theories special? So what's special about the conformal field theories is that you can just guess what the 5D geometry has to be based on symmetries. So usually my field theory has an SO3,1 Poincaré symmetry, or ISO SO3,1. And then in the conformal cases, this gets like enhanced in SO4,2. And this symmetry of the field theory has to be the isometry of the five-dimensional space. And there's just one space-time which has SO4,2 symmetry, which is ADS5. So immediately you know that the string theory dual has to involve this five-dimensional geometry, which captures the internal structure of your string, has to be ADS5. And what this ADS is doing for you is basically has this is the metric of ADS written in Poincaré patch coordinates. And what you see is basically what's happening, that you can absorb a rescaling in your field theory by a translation in the fifth dimension. So if I rescale my four-dimensional space and simultaneously do a translation in the fifth dimension, I get the same metric again. So a conformal field theory is a scale-invariant theory, and the scale-invariance immediately translates into the fact that the metric has to look like this. So I can absorb a scale transformation by a translation in the fifth dimension. And since ADS alone is not a string theory background, we kind of have to attach some extra stuff to this. And this is related to the fact that we don't really know too many examples of non-supersymmetric conformal field theories in four dimensions. I think we did this bank sac thing, but at recoupling, we don't know a single one. And at finite n, we don't know a single one. But at large n, you know something. But you can do maximal supersymmetric super Young Mills. And then n equals 4 super Young Mills is conformal all on its own. It doesn't have any beta function running or any stuff like this. And then what this describes is super Young Mills theory plus some extra matter. There are 4 fermions, 6 scalars. They're all in the adjoint representation, so they have the same counting at large n. They're also given by double lines in this Feynman diagram. So this whole thing reorganizes itself in a closed string Riemann surface expansion. And then this is responsible for having this extra factor, ADS5 times S5. So you get some SO6 symmetry, which rotates all the scalars and fermions into each other. This SO6 symmetry then makes this extra factor of your spacetime S5. But this is like if a compact space. You can still think of this as being a 5D geometry. And the whole thing, so you have 10D strings here compactified on S5 to give you an ADS5. And that's the famous Maldacena conjecture. And as you all know, this can be derived from world field duality. Basically, you look at a bunch of three brains and you find if the open string description gives me a super Young Mills in the decoupling limit. If you describe the same object by its closed string description, so then you want to look at the gravitous back reaction of this object, you find ADS5 times S5 in this alpha prime to zero limit as a near horizon geometry. But it's a full string theory, so I draw this on the next transparency. So if you take the limit on one side, on the open string side, you decouple all the heavy strings, and you're left with n equals 4 super Young Mills, which has these two parameters, lambda and n. The loops are governed by n by the n expansion. On the closed string side, if you take the same limit, you keep all the massive strings, so you really have to do the full type 2p strings here. The only thing that happens is the full three-brain geometry collapses down to this near-horizon geometry, and you have these two parameters, LADS and GS, and GS controls the loop expansion. And then there's this famous, the duality part in here comes that when lambda is small, you can do perturbative Soupe-Young-Mills. When lambda is large, this corresponds to having large ADS curvature radius, which means small curvature, and then you can approximate the right-hand side by doing supergravity, and this is very good, because we don't really know how to do strings here in ADS 5 times its 5, but we know how to do supergravity in ADS 5 times its 5. So that's the most used version of this duality. Then if you look at these non-conformal examples, so what's happening there is that you usually start with a deformation of a conformal field theory, and then you start something with something like this, where so at very high energies, you have a conformal field theory or some theory for which you do know the supergravity dual. And then at very low energies, you want to reduce to SUN Young-Mills or super-Young-Mills, depending on your taste, what you want to describe, actually. And so what you really end up doing is you have a gravity dual, which is dual to a theory, which is what you want in the IR, and then has some extra heavy stuff. And the extra heavy stuff is added in such a fashion that in the UV, you reduce to something where you do know the supergravity dual for. And then what you really want to do is you want to take this limit where the mass of the extra stuff goes to infinity. For example, this could be that if you take n equals 4 super-Young-Mills mass deformed, then at some point these extra scalars and fermions have to come back in, so you can make them massive. Then you want to send their mass to infinity. Or there are some other examples where this extra stuff has some six-dimensional modes. But you always have this extra stuff. You want to send it to infinity while keeping lambda fixed. And the problem with this is if you want to take this limit, because you know what the dimensional transmutation in QCD, you know that if you want to take the ratio of mass over lambda QCD to infinity, that the strength of the coupling at the scale of these extra massive guys has to be very weak. So taking this limit where you send the extra stuff to infinity, keeping lambda QCD fixed, you require a weak coupling at the scale at which these extra things come in, which basically means you have to go beyond supergravity. So you really have to understand string theory if you want to take this limit. And so the more useful way to think about this is that instead of getting QCD, you get a theory similar to QCD, which is QCD plus this extra matter, and you don't take the decoupling limit. You have this extra matter around whose mass is just order one numbers times lambda QCD. So this is not QCD. This is QCD plus some extra heavy, but not heavy enough stuff to really make it. I mean, this heavy matter makes a theory different. But still, some of the theories in this class, so that they look like QCD or SUSY QCD plus this extra matter, have some similar physics to QCD. So there are some theories out there which are confining, have chiral symmetry breaking, and which do have a dual, for which we do know that they do have a string theory dual, and we know it because the string theory dual is well described by doing supergravity calculations. And the dual then looks roughly like this. So in the conformal examples, we had this ADS, where the geometry extends all the way from some boundary to the horizon. The field theory is kind of living out here. And then in the confining examples, what's basically happening is that instead of running all the way down to the horizon, there's some finite distances which the geometry just stops, and the physics that's going on down here is basically correspondence to lambda QCD to the scale of the confining physics. Okay, so this was all review. What I want to do today is add fundamental flavors. So in this general picture, Toft already told us how to introduce fundamental flavors. The big difference of a fundamental flavor as opposed to an edge-joint flavor is that in the double line notation, it still is a single line. So now if you do the same large N counting, you find that this time you get Riemann surfaces associated with an open string theory. You find that the Feynman diagrams again reorganize themselves into an expansion in terms of Riemann surfaces. But this time, Riemann surfaces get weighted with a power of n to the 2 minus 2g as before, minus b. You can have boundaries in your diagrams because you have these fundamental flavors which can have a single line, and then so the number of boundaries is just the number of quark lines appearing in your Feynman diagrams. So what's happening is that by adding these fundamental flavors, the quarks, you added in the open string sector on the dual string theory description. And since the same Polyakov argument also works for open strings, so they also should have some internal structure, then you would expect that adding the matter in the fundamental representation should correspond to adding spacetime filling D-brains. So by spacetime filling D-brains, you basically just mean you allow for open strings. Little reminder for those who don't do string theory every day. It's String theory is a little bit confusing in the sense if you take a string which has Neumann boundary conditions in all directions so that the string can move whatever it wants, just no momentum flowing off the ends, then this we would call a space-time filling D-brain, even so D stands for Dirichlet. So if you have no Dirichlet boundary conditions whatsoever, it's a space-time filling D-brain. It's a D-brain that's everywhere. So we want to add the open string sector to the theory if we want to include fundamental flavors. And if you use the following names, which is a little unconventional, but at large end, it's very useful. So I call glue anything that's in the adjoint representation. I call quarks anything that's in the fundamental representations. So in particular, for me, all these adjoint fermions and scalars in the n equals 4 superambles, I call them all glue because it gives. So this is closed strings. This is open strings. You're led to this following picture that the 4D glue is dual to some five-dimensional geometry, and the four-dimensional quarks then correspond to adding the open string sector, correspond to space-time filling D-brains. And one interesting thing you can do in addition is basically you take a limit where. So the difficult thing is that if you add these space-time filling D-brains, what they really would do is they go back and change this five-dimensional geometry because you're solving gravity in the bulk, and every time you add something new, you add some new stress energy like the stress energy of the space-time filling D-brains, you would have to go back and resolve your geometry. This is something we don't want to do because I want to make use of this fact that for some field series, we already know what the dual geometry is. The way you can get around this is basically you take a limit where you can neglect this back reaction. And the limit you do, we call this a probe limit, is that basically you take this usual Toft limit where you send the coupling to zero and send the number of colors to infinity, keeping the Toft coupling fixed. But at the same time, you keep the number of flavors fixed. So you send the number of colors to infinity, but you keep the number of flavors finite. In other words, you send this combination G and F to zero. And it turns out that it's precisely G and F that governs the back reaction of the flavors, not NF alone. So in this limit, you have no back reaction. And having no back reaction, a lattice person would call you're quenched. Basically, you're neglecting the fermion loops, you're neglecting the quantum dynamics of the fermions on the glue background geometry. And this becomes a rigorous limit if you take this limit. So for real QCD, this would be bad because NF is the same order of NC. But if you take a limit where NC goes to infinity and NF doesn't, this is a rigorously limit. I mean, it's not some bad approximation. This is just a limit in which this description becomes exact. Okay, so let's just entertain what this would mean if this picture is correct. And it turns out that for this to be correct, you need some rather peculiar properties of D-brains to be true. So for one, these D-brains are space-time filling, but I want them to be stable. And because they're space-time filling, you know that they can't carry any charge. If you have a space-time filling object that carries charge, they would be tadpoles. This is a reflection of this famous fact that on a compact space you can't put a charge because the field lines wouldn't have anywhere to end. On a compact space, the net charge has to be zero. In particular, a space-time filling object can't carry any charge. And most of the D-brains we know are stable because they are BPS objects, which means that their tension is equal to their charge. So we want D-brains which are space-time filling, so they can't carry any charge, but still they should be stable. The next funny thing is if you start thinking about how a massive quark should look like. So if you want to give mass to the quark, you would think of something like this. So you know in field theory what's happening is if you look at energy scales which are much bigger than the mass, you have to have the quark does exist. It contributes to processes. So the open strings should be included in the spectrum. Whereas if you look at low energies, energies much less than the mass of the quarks, all your processes should involve diagrams with closed strings only. If you throw this together with one more fact known about all these gravity field theory correspondences, namely the UV-IR connection, which basically is telling you that in terms of scale sizes, what's happening close to the boundary corresponds to the UV of the field theory, what's happening close to the horizon of the anti-de Sitter space is the IR of the field theory, or in these confining examples like Klebanov-Strassler, instead of having this horizon, you would have this end of space, which corresponds to the confining dynamics. But it's always what's close to the boundary is UV, what's close to the interior is IR. And then you're led to a picture like this. So you want D-brains which do something like this. They end in the middle of nowhere. They are space-time filling in the UV region, and then they just stop, and there are no D-brains left in the IR region. This is what the dual of a massive quark has to look like. And the funny thing about it is that this D-brain has to end for no good reason in the middle of nowhere. And the last thing that's a little bit strange is chiral symmetry. So in ADS CFT a global symmetry current maps to a gauge field in the bulk. So you have the SUNF global flavor symmetry current has to map to a gauge field in the bulk, and that's perfect because the space-time filling D-brain, which I claim we have to introduce, has an gauge field living on it, an SUNF gauge field living on its world volume. So you can see that this global symmetry current indeed maps to a gauge field living on the world volume of the D-brain. So that's all fine. But now QCD doesn't have an SUNF global symmetry, but it has this chiral SUNF left times SUNF right symmetry. So what you really need to describe flavors in QCD is somehow two sets of distinguishable D-brains, the A and the B, each of them coming with an SUNF gauge field, and each of these gauge fields being dual to one of these two global symmetry currents. The nice thing about this is if this holds up, then you immediately get a picture of what chiral symmetry breaking should look like. Because if I have A-type D-brains and B-type B-brains, there will be some field, and in particular there could be a scalar field coming from strings that stretch from the A-type brains to the B-type brains. And this will be in the bifundamental representation, so bifundamental under SUNF left times SUNF right. And then if this scalar gets a vacuum expectation value, this would Higgs in the bulk the global product symmetry down to the diagonal subgroup. So chiral symmetry breaking in the conformal field theory on the boundary should correspond to just the classical Higgs mechanism in the bulk, where the Higgs field is sitting in the string stretching from one type of D-brain to the other type of D-brain. And they are space-time filling, so I'll give you a geometric interpretation for this later, but from the five-dimensional point of view, they can't move. There's a scalar field, but you have to find some interpretation for the scalar field from some higher dimensional point of view.
Was it ever a particular point on the biosphere?
Yeah, so that's... we will see this later. Okay, so what I said so far is that including flavors in the string theory description of QCD should be done by including space-time filling D-brains, but it requires D-brains to have some rather strange properties, and I listed three of them. For one, we want the D-brains to be stable but not to carry any charge. We want the D-brains to come in different varieties with bifundamental scalars giving me these Higgs fields which correspond to chiral symmetry breaking, and we want the D-brains to be able to end in the middle of nowhere. And just one little remark I wrote down there that usually would say C is totally ridiculous because the charge of the brain has to go somewhere, the flux has to go somewhere, so brains always have to end on something. But because our brains don't carry any charge, at least C isn't ridiculous, but could in principle be possible. And of course, in the rest of the talk, I want to show you that these things actually do happen. So, and for this, we analyze these series, these supersymmetric cousins of QCD for which the gravity dual is known, and we're going to introduce space-time field, I mean these D-brains which correspond to flavors in there. And as a reminder, in all of this we are going to work only in this probe limit, which was this limit where we keep the TOF coupling fixed but send the back reaction to zero. So GSNC is this TOF coupling fixed, large NC, but GSNF goes to zero. So that's quenched in lattice language. And to see that this does something good for you in the string theory language, you can simply observe that the string theory effective action has a 1 over G squared in front of the Einstein-Hilbert term, and the D-brain tension goes like 1 over G. So if you want to look at the size of the ADS space is going to be given by some GSNC, so that's precisely what you keep fixed. You keep a finite-size ADS space from the back reaction of the three brains, of this, the glue has some finite-size geometry. But then the back reaction of the flavor brains in the same spirit is governed by G and F, and this we take to zero. So no back reaction from the flavor brains. Okay, so the first thing that I have to show you are the space-time filling stable brains. And we're going to make string theory solve this problem for us. So we are going to engineer some serious fundamental flavors in string theory, and then we just observe how this looks like. And for the three-brain system, people have done this already before, and the way you introduce flavors in a very symmetric fashion is by adding seven brains. These flavors, they preserve still half of the supersymmetry, so you have the N equals 4 super young mills, and then you add a bunch of, the M is what I called NF before, you add a bunch of N equals 2 preserving hypermultiplets, which means you add a hypermultiplet which couples to the adjoint in the usual N equals 2 superpotential fashion, X, Q, Q tilde, where these are the two chiral multiplets in the hypermultiplet. And Usually you would have thrown away the theory and have to include some oriented folds in order to make it conformal, because the theory has a non-vanishing beta function. It's actually asymptotically non-free, but the beta function is proportional to GM, and in this probe limit in which we are working, the theory actually is conformal. Which just, I mean, we are neglecting all these effects which are of order GM. We are neglecting the whole back reaction. And you can actually, in this particular example, you can go beyond the probe limit. This was done following a work by Aharoni, Fayasuddin, and Maldacena. But they always include these oriented folds in addition, so that even beyond the probe limit, you have a conformal field theory. So because we neglect the back reaction, or we turn off the back reaction, it's probably better to say the glue is still 80 is 5 times as 5. So my glue is still the N equals 4 super Young Mills, and it's still captured by this 80 is 5 times as 5 geometry. So that's 80 is 5, that's the S5. Then now we just have to look how these D7 brains embed themselves in there. So you allow the D7 brains to minimize their world volume, but you don't include the back reaction of the D7 brains on the background. And then this is what the D7 brains look like in this geometry. So these quarks, which are my D7 brains, they are spacetime filling in the 80 is 5, and they live on S3 inside the S5. And this is an equatorial S3, meaning the radius of the S3 is the radius same as the radius of the S5. So they're sitting kind of on the equator of this S5. And this doesn't carry any charge from the five-dimensional point of view, which is basically all we required. I was always talking about this five-dimensional spacetime. And they don't carry any charge because they wrap a topologically trivial cycle in the S5. The S3 is a topologically trivial S3 inside the S5, so there's no charge induced in lower dimensions. So the reason why people usually don't like this, always want to compactify in topologically non-trivial cycles, is that you have to worry about stability. Why does this 7 brain stay put on the equator? Why doesn't it just slip off? Why doesn't it slip off and just contract to a point on the North Pole? Often this happens because of flux stabilization, but you can easily see that there's no flux stabilization going on in the setup. This mode size, or the scalar field which corresponds to fluctuations in the position of this brain on the sphere is really negative mass mode. If you plot the potential for the 7 brain, so this is the world volume potential of the 7 brain from the 7 brain point of view, you find it's proportional to sine cubed. So the potential looks like this. The 7 brain where I wanted to put living on the equator is sitting on top of a potential hill. This is a solution to the equations of motion, but naively you would say it's an unstable solution because you have this negative mass mode, and indeed the 7 brain can gain potential energy by contracting down to a point. So everything like your naive geometrical intuition would have told you, it's an unstable configuration. If you sit on top of a potential hill, and you could roll down this hill. So why doesn't the D7 brain slip off? And the way this works is due to the dynamics of ADS space, and there's something called the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound, which is doing all the magic for us. And the statement of the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound is, in ADS, there's no instability due to a scalar field with negative mass, as long as the mass isn't too negative. As long as the mass is bigger than -4 in ADS units, you don't get an instability, even if you have a negative mass mode. If you look at this slipping, if you have a potential, you can just evaluate the second derivative up there, and then you find that the mass of the slipping mode actually is -3. So -3 is bigger than -4. This is not an instability. So you might wonder where this all came from. This all sounds like magic. So here's an intuitive way how to understand the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound. If you want to understand it quantitatively, you have to read the papers of Brighton-Lohner-Friedman. But the intuitive way is that basically anti-de Sitter space behaves very much like a box. Whenever you want to study a finite energy excitation in ADS, it has to vanish at the boundary. So if you want to excite some field in anti-de Sitter space, it always has a shape like this and has to die down to zero at the boundary. And this basically is telling you that any fluctuation which you want to create always has some kinetic energy associated with it. Because if you have some finite excitation somewhere in the center of ADS, it has to go down to zero at some finite distance away. And there's always going to be some non-vanishing kinetic energy associated with this. In flat space, you can make the kinetic energy associated to a fluctuation arbitrarily small by making the fluctuation arbitrarily spread out. In ADS, you can't. There's always some kinetic energy with any kind of fluctuations. And then now you have to do some balance. You have to see whether the win in potential energy, so you create a fluctuation which wants to make the 7 brain down the hill, this will give a win in potential energy, but you have to pay a price in kinetic energy. And then if you analyze this, you find a quantitative criterion for how steep does the potential hill have to be? So not this thing, the potential hill I showed you before. How steep does it have to be so that the gain in potential energy outweighs the cost in kinetic energy? And then this leads to this Brayton-Lohner-Friedman bound of the mass being bigger than -4, then no instability. And in order to see what the slipping mode means in the dual control in the dual field theory, we need one more fact about the ADS-CFT correspondence. This is just how the dictionary works. The fields in the bulk correspond to operators on the boundary, and then the mass of the field in the bulk corresponds to the dimension of the field on the boundary. Witten wrote down a precise formula how to map this to that, but the only thing which we need to know is that this distinction whether the mass is negative, zero, or bigger than zero corresponds to relevant, marginal, and irrelevant operators on the boundary. So this mass, this naively tachyonic-looking mode, this mass minus 3 mode on the boundary should correspond to relevant deformation on the... So the negative mass mode in the bulk should correspond to relevant deformation on the boundary. And there's one more piece to this dictionary, namely that normalizable... The normalizable... Every field has two possible boundary behaviors. You solve a second-order differential equation of motion for the fields in the bulk, and you find that of the two solutions, one is normalizable, and the coefficient of the normalizable solution you would interpret as the VEF of the corresponding operator. The non-normalizable solution corresponds to adding the operator to the Lagrangian as a given coefficient.
When you say the mass on the ADS side, is that in the sense of including the curvature of the potential, or is that the energy in the ADS side?
It's the curvature of the potential. I mean,
I think it was -3.
Yeah. It's also like in terms of representation theory, that's what people usually call the mass of ADS. You evaluate the Casimir of the representation and subtract out a constant so that the short representation is called massless. Okay, and from this you can see that this mass -3, if you work out what the dual operator is, corresponds to the quark the mass term. So this immediately tells us how problem one is going to solve problem two. We found a scalar field which corresponds to turning on the mass, so we're just going to turn on the mass by turning on a profile for this particular scalar field. And again, we let string theory do this for us. So part two was how to introduce massive quarks. So I showed you this space-time filling stable brain. Now we want to make it massive. And the way you make it massive in string theory is just you take your 7 brains and remove them a little bit from the 3 brain. So these hypermultiplets came from the strings that stretched from 7 brain to 3 brain. If you separate 3 brain and 7 brain, these guys become massive. And now you're describing the same system with massive quarks instead of massless quarks. And the mass is proportional to the distance. And basically all you have to do in order to figure out how this looks from the ADS 5 times this 5 point of view is you have to translate this equation, which describes the embedding of my spacetime into how this looks in the ADS 5 times the 5. And then the following picture emerges. My D7 brain does what I advertised in the very beginning it should do. It's spacetime filling in the UV region, and then it just ends somewhere in the ADS 5. And the way it ends is basically this becomes more reasonable if you look at how the solution looks from the 10-dimensional point of view. The D7 is wrapping the same S3 inside the S5 deep in the UV, but then as you move into the IR, as you move into the ADS space, the D7 brain starts slipping off the sphere. And at some point, it reaches the North Pole, and that's the point at which the brain ends, and then there's no 7 brain anymore in deeper to the IR. The way this looks from the 5-dimensional point of view is that you have this brain, and if you plot its tension as a function of this U coordinate, you use this coordinate that runs from the boundary down to the horizon, then the tension of the brain decreases, which is possible because this scalar field that was basically negative mass, so you decrease the potential energy, you decrease the tension of the brain. At some point, the brain tension reaches zero, and then it can just stop. And you can actually write down the equation, and you can show that this embedding actually solves the equations of motion. It preserves half of the supersymmetries. So we did all these checks. And then you can just... So this is precisely of the form which we advertised above. It's a scalar field in the bulk, and if you look at the behavior of the solution close to the boundary, you find the leading piece, which you interpret as mass. And then naively we have a sub-leading piece, but whenever the leading piece is turned on, you have to be more careful in the interpretation of the sub-leading piece. If you actually go back to the original dictionary, you find that after some work that the sub-leading piece actually goes away, and you get precisely what you would have expected from the field tree. You have a leading term turned on, so there's a mass, but there's no VEF for this fermion bilinear, which like it should be. If you give a mass to the quarks, they shouldn't develop a vacuum expectation value at the same time. Okay, and from the higher dimensional point of view, it's also clear what's happening. This D7 brain just doesn't end at all. It smoothly closes off. So you have this S3, which is shrinking down to a point while the brain is extending into the ADS. So this is some smooth configuration from the 10-dimensional point of view. And in 10-dimension, you can just show that this thing is BPS like it is. But
which scan?
Also, right now I'm still talking about it's a conformal field tree, and I added quarks, so there's no QCD scale in the game yet. This is when we go to Klebanov square, so this should be true. But so far, I added fundamental flavors to ADS to this n equals 4 super young Mills, which doesn't have any scale. It's a conformal theory. So the only scale in the game is the mass. And from what I said earlier, you should expect, this does have a higher dimension interpretation, but even if you have a theory which doesn't have a higher dimension interpretation, you would still expect it. If in ADS you have one of these taxions above the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound, which means you have a scalar field which can decrease the tension of the brain, you should have these situations where brains can stop. So even though you have tachyons, this might just mean that it's not an instability, but it's just the ability to have a brain whose tension smoothly goes to zero and then at some point stops. So what I showed you in the last 2 points was that brains with this world volume tachyon above the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound can precisely be stable without any charge, and they can end in thin air. So they do what have two of the properties which we wanted our brain stool to flavors to have. So now let's look at this third property, which was a chiral symmetry and then chiral symmetry breaking. And before before I say a few words about chiral symmetry, I want to study a model which we can actually solve, which is a toy model which has a product global symmetry, SUM times SUM, but it's a non-chiral symmetry. So this will already show all the effects which we then expect to be true also in the chiral models, but it's just easier to analyze. And this non-chiral example for product global symmetry you get again from 3 brains, 7 brains, and this time what you do is you take some of the 7 brains and rotate them by 90 degrees, and then you give them a new name. You call them D7 prime brains. And this has an SUM global symmetry associated with this stack of 7 brains and a different SUM global symmetry associated with this stack of 7 brains. And what you did on the field theory side, you still have this n equals 4 super young Mills with the 3 chiral adjoint fields, so 6 scalars assemble themselves into 3 chiral superfields of n equals 1 supersymmetry, and then you added the first bunch of 7 brains, broke your supersymmetry down to n equals 2, and you added this n equals 2 preserving superpotential, and the second kind of 7 brains does the same. It also would be n equals 2 preserving all on its own, but what's happening is that the fields couple to a different adjoint chiral multiplet, so the whole theory only preserves n equals 1 supersymmetry. And that's also where this SUM times SUM comes from. So naively, you would have said you should get an SU2M global symmetry, but because of the superpotential, you actually only have an SUM rotating the Q quarks and a different SUM rotating the T quarks. You can't rotate Q quarks into T quarks. Then if you try to see how this looks like from the 10-dimensional point of view, picture looks very similar. Both the A-type, now one of them, the D7s I call A-type, the D7 primes I call B-type. So both of them are space-time filling from the ADS5 point of view as you wanted it to be. But if you look on what they are doing on the S5, still each of them individually wraps an S3 inside the S5, but they wrap different S3s. And these S3s are kind of orthogonal to each other and intersect along common S1. And then on this along this intersection, if you analyze the spectrum of the open strings, you find that along the intersection you have there's a scalar field sitting there. It's 6-dimensional, but it also gets compactified down as well. And there's a bifundamental scalar field sitting, and this is precisely the scalar field which I advertised before we need in order to see the chiral condensate. And it's dual to these mass terms which are off diagonal in the Q and T quarks. And if you give a VF to this VAC, to this bifundamental scalar field in the A, the B strings, you Higgs in the bulk, the SUM times SUM down to a diagonal SUM, and this is what in the chiral theory you would call a chiral condensate. Of course, in the example we study here, all I did is I just added a mass term instead of having some chiral condensate. And from the bulk point of view, having a chiral condensate and having a mass term is actually quite similar. It's due to the fact that deformations of the Lagrangian are leading terms, and VEFs are sub-leading terms for the scalar field. But both of them do basically the same in the bulk. You turn on a profile for the scalar field, and this non-zero profile gives this breaking of SUM times SUM down to SUM by the Higgs mechanism. So both explicit and spontaneous symmetry breaking correspond to a Higgs mechanism in the bulk, and the only difference between spontaneous and explicit breaking is whether the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs dies down at infinity or whether it stays finite at infinity. So to say this once more in formulas, so H, this is the six-dimensional scalar field coming from the bifundamental, from the string stretching from the A-type range to the B-type range, is dual to this operator Q T tilde. So a profile for H means that I did something to this operator Q T tilde. And if you look at the profile for H, you find that if this leading term A is turned on, what you did, you added Q T tilde to the Lagrangian. If the sub-leading term is turned on, you would interpret this as Q T tilde getting a vacuum expectation value. And if you look at the example which I just presented to you, you basically find that the thing which is very easy to study is when you turn on A and give basically add QT with the coefficient M, so you give a mass, an off-diagonal mass to these Q and T flavors, but you don't have any vacuum expectation value. Now, how this looks like from string theory, basically what's happening is if you give a VEF to the six-dimensional field, what's happening is that the D7 brains and the D7 prime brains, they merge into one smooth curve, and then explicitly the SUM times SUM, which you had from having two distinct types of brains, gets Higgs down to a diagonal SUM because now you basically only have one D7 brain wrapping a smooth curve. So you can write orthogonal intersecting brains, you can write down as an equation UV equals zero, which has two solutions, U equals zero or V equals zero. Then giving a VEF to the six-dimensional scalar field corresponds to taking this curve and deforming it into UV being epsilon. And this epsilon is the product of these two coefficients. So I added a new term in my superpotential, which is a mass term given by H and H tilde, and that's this parameter epsilon. And this, if we can explicitly write down the solution again, so there's a profile for the scalar field, and you can see that the leading term is turned on, so this is explicit breaking. But as I said before, both explicit breaking and condensation would both look like an SUM times SUM getting Higgs in the bulk down to the SUM. And what we exhibited here is the version where we have the explicit mass breaking terms, not the interesting dynamics where this is generated dynamically, but it's added by hand to the Lagrangian. And for chiral symmetry breaking, then you would expect the same mechanism, but it should be a normalizable profile instead of this non-normalizable profile. So, okay, the lesson to be learned from what I just said is so these A-type brains and B-type brains, which I advertised before, from the higher dimensional point of view, you can distinguish by what cycle they wrap, and indeed you should think of the Higgs mechanism in the bulk as being the dual of the chiral condensate, and it takes the SUNF times SUNF down to the diagonal SUNF. And from the geometrical point of view, this is basically what's happening, is you have a smooth merger of the two cycles into one. And the next thing which one should discuss is chirality. This, unfortunately, is still work in progress. So to see real chiral symmetry breaking, now we have to study more exciting field theory. As I said before, there is a very interesting field theory out there which actually is confining, for which the supergravity dual is known, which is this Klebanov-Strasser solution. So what one should do is just do the same analysis I so far only did for the conformal examples, also in these examples which are confining backgrounds. And one thing that's basically already happened is that Uranga and others showed that if you do, so this Klebanov-Strasser solution is associated with putting these three brains on the conic fold, that's some particular geometry. But if you look at this Klebanov-Strasser solution, then it's already clear that this configuration of seven brains, which I've been always using before to construct the solutions for me, each of these seven brains gives rise to a single chiral flavor only. So the system of seven and seven prime brains, which I just introduced to get a non-chiral product global symmetry, will give me a chiral product symmetry. You can even go further and you can write down the same equation for what is believed to be a solution of the equations of motion. You just still have to check that it is actually true, and that's still work in progress. So on the chiral symmetry, I don't have any results yet, but I would believe that the same mechanism should work. But we exhibited all the results in the conformal case already. Okay, so here's a summary of the things that did work. So what I hope I showed you I was way too fast. So in the 45 minutes I did talk, I hope I showed that including a few flavors into large N-gauge series can easily be achieved by inclusion of space-time filling D-brains. And for this to work, you need some rather surprising features of D-brains, and all of them rely on this dynamics associated with the Bryson-Lohner-Friedman bound to actually work in the supersymmetric examples we studied, the superconformal examples we studied. And here are the three properties. So what you need is you need stable, neutral D-brains. You need brains that can end in thin air. And you need these brains which come in these two types of varieties, which a scalar field in the bifundamental sector stretching from one to the other. And I hope I convince you that all three of these happen in the supersymmetric cousins of QCT for which the closed string theory dual is known. Thank you. So the giant gravitons are stabilized by some fluxes, right? So their world volume is not ADS. I think it's a quite different mechanism that makes them. But they're stabilized by the five, by this Westermino coupling, right? They wrap a three-dimensional spatial cycle one time, and then they move around. So effectively, they can have a non-zero pullback of the four form to their world volume, and then. If you were to plot this potential, which I've been plotting before, they would be sitting at a minimum of their potential, which is good because their world volume is just R. There's no ADS factor due to the world volume, so they couldn't rely on Bryson-Lohner-Friedman to make them stable. And they do carry charge, right? They have some angular momentum which appears as a charge from the lower dimensional point of view. So I think they're quite different. I mean, there are various kind of objects which you can put on S5, and so there are these two mechanisms by which you can make topologically trivial cycles stable, and I think this is a different mechanism. This is not flux stabilization. This is stabilization due to the dynamics of ADS. I wrote down these formulas for the superpotential. So one corresponds to having a superpotential basically xqq tilde, and if you do this, seven brains, three brains, and if you take say two m of them and just give them, call m of them t and m of them q, would have a superpotential like this. And then I said that if they are rotated by 90 degrees, so I have these three adjoint chiral supermultiplets. So this I claim corresponds to a superpotential where you have xqq tilde and ytt tilde, and then doing an arbitrary rotation angle will basically, so this will come with a 10 and this with a 1/10. So the in between situation will have both kind of potentials. It will have the xtt tilde superpotential and the ytt tilde superpotential, and the coefficients will be given by some trigonometric function of the angle. So if you have an arbitrary angle, you will have both the tt tilde and the xtt tilde and the ytt tilde term. So as soon as you rotate a little bit, you break this SU2m global symmetry, which you naively had explicitly down to an SUm times SUm, because you no longer can rotate t flavors into q flavors. So it's a parameter in your gauge theory which you can tune. It's one parameter in the mass matrix, or in this, not mass matrix, in this cubic coupling matrix in the superpotential.
Questions? No, let's thank you.